Hey, welcome to Beer Sessions Radio on the Heritage Radio Network. I'm Jimmy Carboni from Jimmy's Number 43 and the Good Beer Seal. This is a very special extra cider session with Gay Howard and Kay Michael from United States of Cider. This is March 2015. We're kicking off a special Irish craft beer launch at Jimmy's Number 43 with Anthony and John from Rowan Imports. And we've got representatives from Craigie's and Dan Kelly's, two great new Irish craft ciders. So let's start with Anthony from Rowan Imports. Tell us about how you got this Irish craft cider portfolio together, because it's really exciting. And right now we're drinking the Craigie's. We started out, my stomach was upset. I needed my first drink of the day, and Craigie's is doing the trick.
Well, actually, something new for us. We found these guys on Twitter, and John and I have never really been social media people. Gay has been teaching us, and we're getting a little bit better. But yeah, this is the first time we've ever found somebody through the web like that. Normally, we find people just by going to areas that we know produce amazing cider and wandering around. But after a quick conversation and speaking with Emma, Simon's wife, we flew over to Ireland and got to just hang out with them and go and visit all of their orchards. So Olin's sister picked me up from the airport, wandering around, and we went straight to his place. And from there, was there for a week, just really checking out everything that they have, and it's amazing.
That's really great stuff. And John, you're part of the Rowan Imports. I mean, how is it for you guys? You've got some great French, German, Asturian, and
Asturian, also Basque ciders from Spain. We've really tried to expand in all different directions. We've also radically beefed up our local portfolio. So recently, we took on Eden's ice cider from Vermont and Michigan. We're looking at some West Coast ciders. So we're really trying to rebrand cider both domestically and internationally, and just it's a standalone drink and it can hold its own versus wine or beer. So that's our message.
Hear that? Listen to that pour. It's amazing. So Sláinte, Gay, how do you say it? Sláinte. So we brought some materials with us. Gay, you brought a cider book. What is it? Sláinte, The Complete Guide to Irish Craft Beer and Cider by Carolyn Hennessy and Kristen Jensen. How long have you had that book? Is it a new book?
Yeah, the book just came out, and I got it on Amazon a couple weeks ago, but it's a nice overview if you don't know very much about Irish craft beer and cider, and they have all kinds of tips and pairing and background information, so
all right. Book. Let's cut to the chase. So we got Simon Terrell from Craigie's. Welcome to the show.
Thank you very much.
And this gentleman, Olin McNeese from Dan Kelly's.
Hi.
So tell us a little background on your brands, how you got started, and what inspired you, because it seemed like not too long ago there were just mass marketed Irish ciders out there.
I come from a wine background, spent 20 years working in the wine business, and then in 2009 decided to go and do a winemaking degree. And after I finished the degree, I came home, and obviously there was a distinct lack of vineyards in Ireland, so the closest thing that we have to wine is cider. I find it quite frustrating when we get lumped in with beer all the time, because we ferment cider like we ferment wine. We don't brew it. We do it once a year. We have an annual crop. We just can't produce it on a weekly basis. So I wanted to try my hand at something. I couldn't move to France, so I had a crack at cider. Now, started in 2011, and realized after about two or three vintages that actually it can be as easily as complex as wine.
Well, that's great.
Yeah, of your two ciders that you have there, you have the Ballyhook Flyer, and then you have the Dalliance. Mm-hmm. The Dalliance, by far, I mean, that is a full-on method Champenois, correct?
Yeah, and the idea is there's extended lees aging, so it's 15 months on its lees, to really try and develop some of these autolytic characters that you find in sparkling wine. Mm-hmm. And so you're getting away from the kind of primary apple aromas and getting biscuity, yeasty characters as well.
But there's some great history behind Irish cider, isn't there?
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, it's been, if you read back in, I'm not sure who wrote about it, but a couple of hundred years ago, I think it was a Dutchman traveling in Ireland, said that that he tasted Irish cider back then and declared it to be as good as many of the great European wines. So it's been around a long time.
I read in Sláinte that the fine for cutting down a tree in Ireland was 5 cows, I think it is.
that would be in Brand.
Yeah. Double if it was achieved.
Yeah. In Brand times.
You know, yeah, okay, not anymore.
No. We need to stop the house, so.
I was just worried about that. Yeah, can you tell us a little bit more about like the apple varieties that you use? Because that's one of the things that at Roman Imports we've really been trying to educate people on, that narrative of the variety of apple that goes into it, how you raise them or how you grow them. So like, where are your apples from?
Well, I think at this point I might pass over to Odin because he's one of the leading apple growers in the country. So,
I suppose, yeah. So we would, if I speak for our own cider, Dan Kelly cider, we would use some Bramley, which is a culinary variety. It's a relatively bitter apple. We use some specific cider varieties as well, and then we'll back sweeten with dessert varieties. And depending on what we're trying to achieve, we'll have a ability to work out of different varieties. On our own orchard, we'll grow approximately 20 varieties, given that we have a very small amount of cider fruit, with quite a lot of Bramley fruit, and we also have dessert. And desserts are used to help pollinate the Bramley apple. So we'll use the Bramley apple for kind of stability and pH. We don't use, our own cider, we don't use any added acids or anything like that. So we use Bramley for pH, we use the cider fruit for some tannins, and we use just different, depending on what we want to achieve, we use a different amount of sweet dessert apples to back sweeten before we carbonate and pasteurize our cider. So we have no additives whatsoever in our own cider. In terms of growing the apples, we have a very kind, benign little microclimate. We're very close to the sea. We're on the Boyne Valley, the River Boyne. We have a height, an altitude.
Dan Kelly's,
yeah. So our orchards are about approximately 80 to 100 feet above sea level, about a mile from the sea. So we have a very benign microclimate, which suits growing apples. We don't have early frosts at blossom time. You have a nice soil profile, well drained, free draining, good balanced soil. So, we have a very kind little environment for that.
This is open to everyone here. So, just as a general question, what are the great, or are there great cider apple growing regions in the world, or can you grow cider apples anywhere?
Well, I think there are thousands of varieties of apples, and each one will suit. Each one can be grown anywhere, more or less. How suitable they are to particular climates is another question. Mm-hmm. If you take a Bramley apple, it tends to suit a kind of a relatively cool summered climate. So it works well in Ireland because of our cool summers and the UK. But even in the difference between the north of the UK and the south of the UK, which is more like a French climate, there will be a big difference in the quality of the fruit. Mm-hmm. So, we could grow any dessert variety that you would be familiar with. But could we do it well might be another issue. So you try to pick cultivars, varieties that suit your location, the type of summers you have, your spring blossom time, and when you're going to be likely to harvest. And for dessert varieties, sunlight hours would be important if you want them to color up, and that's for, say, if you want to market them for fresh sale. If you're using them to make cider with, then you can more or less plant any apple anywhere, I think.
But I don't think it's by coincidence though that we find most of the great ciders come out of the Asturias, Brittany, Normandy, UK, and we would consider our own obviously to be to be very good as well. And that sort of slightly edgy climate where the apples ripen but they really only just ripen is always going to produce more complex flavors than when if you're growing apples in a hotter climate where you're going to get lots of sugar accumulation but not necessarily the sugar acid balance that makes the cider so complex.
So it's the maritime climate that we would experience in the area, the benefit of the Gulf Stream, all that type of relatively benign climate conditions. Mm-hmm. And there is no doubt that, again, if you look at apples in the south of England that tend to get that late heat in the summer, they don't have flavour to the same degree. So kind of
There's a little bit of rivalry there. England versus Ireland.
I don't know what you're talking about.
what would you say the stylistic differences are between English and Irish ciders?
Well, my experience, a lot of the traditional English ciders would tend to be still very low carbonation, mm-hmm. quite dry. That would be a particular style to the UK. I think our own ciders in Ireland tend to be a little sweeter. For me, a bit more palatable. Maybe not very highly carbonated, but certainly will feature some carbonation. Mm-hmm. We did a draft for a show recently with very low carbonation, and we were really surprised, amazed, in fact, at how well the Irish people took to it, which is not traditional. But, again, if you go to the Spanish Asturias, Basque country, they tend to be very low carbonation as well.
Oh, yeah.
So that would be a difference. Simon would have a better knowledge of the English ciders. When you go away from the mass market ciders, be it Irish or English, tend to be highly carbonated, highly sugared. That's their style. Coming away from that, it tends to be a bit more integrity to it.
Yeah, we're interested in the specialty craft ciders.
Yeah, there is a difference in the UK between the UK and Ireland as well, because the UK system has allowed a lot of very small producers to flourish, because they have a system there which, if you produce under 7,000 litres a year, you don't pay any excise duty. We pay excise duty on the first litre. So I find in the UK there are huge variations. The general quality is obviously very good, but I think, and I know I'm going to sound very biased here, but I think the overall general quality of Irish cider is actually considerably ahead of our UK rivals.
Well, we've been waiting for you guys for a long time. We got to taste you a little bit in Cider Week New York last October, but Gay and Kay, why don't you guys join in, tasting right now, and we had the
sure.
Craigie's Dalliance, oops, and the Craigie's Ballyhook.
Yeah, I mean, Ballyhook's what I'm drinking right now, and I have to honestly say, I think this is a really beautifully balanced cider. Right off the nose, I got butterscotch and apple peel, so you get a little sweet, and then I'm preparing myself for that apple peel. I'm expecting there to be a lot of astringency and tannin, which the astringency is there very much on the finish, that fuzzy thing on the end of the tongue, and the tannin's right in the middle, and it has a nice long finish, and you even get a little like fruity note there in the beginning, and then towards the end some dried floral notes, some dried grass. It's you said earlier that cider can be as balanced and complex as wine, and this is, I think, a beautiful example of that.
Yeah, well, thank you. I mean, we use 80% cider apple in Ballyhook Flyer, so 80% mm-hmm. of a variety called Davenant, and that's responsible for the color, the mouthfeel, those tannins as well. Mm-hmm. And then we balance that off using a culinary, early ripening culinary variety called Catcha, mm-hmm. Which just brings that little bit of sweetness, and then just rounds off the tannins a little bit as well.
It's funny, but a lot of American cider makers are having an issue finding cider apples, right?
Oh, yeah.
The big challenge is what?
Mm-hmm. Just finding the apples. I mean, Steve Wood at Farnham Hills is by far the largest producer of cider fruit in the United States, which is, amazing what he's been growing. He grows a lot of Davenants as well. That's one of the main ones. Kingston Black is another big mm-hmm. one for the Northeast. Mm-hmm. Other American varieties that we know. Newtown Pippin is a big one.
Right, the Newtown Pippin.
Yeah, all the Pippins mm-hmm. that we find up and down the East Coast. And we're going to try a seedling cider over here eventually from New York. It's really hard to find it. And in the U.S., we don't really know that conversation yet. Very few people understand cider fruit versus dessert fruit. John and I, we're from upstate New York. We're from the Finger Lakes, which is, a huge cider growing or apple growing region. Everybody knows... what's the name of it?
Orchard.
No, I just forgot.
Red Jacket.
Red Jacket Orchard. We see there they've got grape. That's from Geneva, New York, where we grew up. But that's going to be dessert fruit, and that's really what everybody associates with it. And getting people to understand that there are different varieties that go into this, and they each have their unique balance of acid and tannin.
A beautiful pour. I love that.
Wonderful
pour.
Mm-hmm.
We really only have two cider apples that work successfully within our climate. One is Davenant. The other is Michelin. People have trialed other things, but we just don't have the climate to get them ripe. But I think it's a very important part. If you're looking to make a traditional style cider apple is an integral part of that. I mean, it's a god awful looking piece of fruit. you would never consider eating one.
That's why we're on radio. Man. Yeah. This is the ugliest apple I've ever seen.
But what it contributes to a traditional style of cider is everything. All that color and mouthfeel, as I said before, and tannin comes from that horrible.
Ireland has a good amount of cider trees.
No, currently, yeah, you know, there are a lot of cider trees in Ireland. Again, particularly the last two varieties mentioned, Dabhnad, Michelin. You know, we're working hard to try and introduce other varieties and see how well they function for flavour and you know the overall contribution to the fruit. And I do think there's a big place. You know, the specific cider fruit. Lends a lot to the finished product, mm-hmm. and then you can use your other varieties to steer a style in a particular direction. And you know, as I say again, you can use culinary varieties to help stabilize them a little bit as well. So there's a place for all the major groups. But indeed, I suppose the problem with cider fruit is you have no alternate market for it. It only goes to cider. Whereas if you have culinary apples or dessert apples, you know, you're selling them to other people as well. As an apple producer, you have an alternative market.
So, could you give us a little bit of a...
No?
Just tell you what, we have lots more to talk about. We'll be back in a few minutes on our special Cider Sessions with Beer Sessions Radio. All right. Hey, welcome back to Beer Sessions Radio on the Heritage Radio Network. This is a special Irish craft cider special extra sessions with Gay Howard and Kay Michaels of United States of Cider. We've got guys from Dan Kelly's and Craigie's from Ireland and Anthony and John from Rowan Imports. So, all right, guys, we're kind of having a heated debate about should we talk about Magners or not, but, I mean, from what I've read, I've got the book, what is it, Pete Brown's book, World's Best Ciders, which is pretty good. Pete Brown with Bill Bradshaw. And from what I can tell, you guys have had a great history of cider making in Ireland going back thousands of years. And it seems to me that at some point, the same thing happened in America with beer. There was a lot of mass marketing. But I'm trying to tell your story. You guys are coming back with a craft product. But Gay's looking at another book, the Sláinte book, The Complete Guide to Irish Cider. Any great quotes in there about what the hell's going on with Irish cider?
Well, there's a lot of interesting stuff, obviously. It caught my eye earlier that apples have been grown in Ireland for at least 3,000 years, and they feature in the Ulster legends and are mentioned in Irish literature as far back as the 7th century. And they even say that St. Patrick's has been said to have planted a number of apple trees in Ireland. So obviously,
along
apples,
with everything else,
very.
You guys are underselling yourself. You got to go way back. Go deep, guys. I mean, yeah, what does cider mean to you as Irish men?
Well, I suppose probably all alcohol has a particular resonance for Irish people, but cider has been traditionally. You know, it has been used as methods of payment on farms, etc. I can tell stories about, you know, when we had guys picking apples, harvesting apples, you know, we would pay them at the end of the week. And one weekend we ran short of money. We just didn't expect that literally so many bins of apples would be picked. And I was leaving this guy and I said, you know, sure, look, I'll owe you £20 next week or whatever. And he went, yeah. And I said, well, maybe, you know, do you like cider? And he said, yeah, sure. And I said, well, there's some cider. Maybe you'll take that instead of the 20 pounds. And he went, yeah, okay. The next week he came back, he didn't want money. You know, he just wanted cider. So you know, that is the kind of the background, you know, certainly, maybe not of recent times, but certainly in the past, people were paid with some cider. You know, the whole notion that even drinking water wasn't that pure by times and all that kind of thing. But I suppose in the past, maybe 30 years or so, cider had seen... its fortunes had plummeted. It wasn't seen well as a social drink. That kind of mass produced, very sweet drink that appealed to a young audience who didn't kind of know their limits and drank too much cider and all that type of thing. That kind of happened and it became very unpopular. And you know, it's taken a while for cider to have got back up to where it should be in terms of, you know, a local drink, as Simon says, a local
listen to
wine.
That pour, it's amazing.
Yeah, it pours well. So it is a local drink. It is in part of our history, you know. And people are now beginning to appreciate it again in the same way, you know. So we're
well,
certainly
tell us
back.
About, we're drinking the Dan Kelly cider. Are you the cider maker?
Yes. I'm the dog's body, in fact. I kind of do a little bit of everything. So, yeah. So this particular cider is a blend of, as I said earlier, Bramley apple and cider fruit, Dabinet. And then we use some varietals to back sweeten, bicarbonate, pasteurize, and that's it. So, that's our cider there currently at the moment. I suppose for Kay, maybe you'd have an idea of, you know, how you find the bouquet, the feel of it,
sure.
et cetera.
We can talk about that, but first, can I ask you a question?
Sure.
Because I noticed on your label, it says Irish hand-pressed cider. Could you tell us about, like, paint us a picture. What does that mean, hand-pressed?
So we get each apple.
I'm sorry, this is a two-part question.
Okay.
And then how would you, like, what is important about that? How does it...
It's an Irish drinking grain. Take one apple in your two hands.
We have a bob. We use the side of the table now, and we just press really hard.
I like it.
I suppose the hand-press is really to signify that in our scale, it is so manual. Mm-hmm. You know, we have the bulk bins that come out of the orchard will hold around about in pounds 700 or 800 pounds of fruit, mm-hmm. and we would actually take them out of the bins by hand. We're a small scale producer, mm-hmm. into a little elevator. You know, we would select the fruit that we want into a little elevator through a wash into the press, and everything is very manually done. It goes through a little mill into a hopper. We scoop it out into the pressing bags, mm-hmm. and then we operate the equipment to press it. It's a little American machine, a good nature press. We then tip it out, take the pommels out, and again, we separate that. So it's very manual. It's very hands-on. So mm-hmm. hand press is really just to convey that is the kind of the scale that we're in.
Mm-hmm. I think what's important to understand in terms of the style of production that we smaller producers do is that, you know, all we can base our ciders on is the quality of the raw material. We don't have the ability to manipulate them in maybe the way that the larger scale producers would. So it's very important that when the apples come in from the orchard, that we select the fruit very carefully. We throw away anything that's rotten, so that we have this really outstanding primary fruit. And then when we do process it, we handle it with care. So you know that you're not
folding back in fresh juice, you're not folding in apples against corn syrup or anything like that.
No, nothing.
But some of the larger producers do. You know, we've talked with some, I don't want to name them, but I'm not impressed when someone's putting corn syrup into their cider.
No.
The only additions
for ourselves, it doesn't happen.
Yeah, I mean, I think probably Olaf and I are the same in this, that the only additions that we make are some inoculated yeasts. And again, that's something we move premises. So my theory is you need to introduce an inoculated yeast when you're into a new premises to ensure a smoother guaranteed fermentation. But then second year we won't do that and we'll just use non-inoculated yeasts. After that, the only other addition that I make is some sulfites just for guaranteeing freshness, but again, the levels of those are very, very low, 2 grams per 100 litres.
Which is really very, 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 very low by modern standards. And, you know, for ourselves, we kind of, we use just a wild yeast, and we don't use sulfites. It's a good job I have a market for some cider vinegar, so when one when one goes wrong, pull it out to the side, and, you know, we know we have a market for it. But, mm-hmm. you know, I suppose the style, and again, Cider Ireland as an organisation, which is how Anthony and John came about us, I suppose. Mm-hmm. Cider Ireland would have a fairly strict criteria as to how you can make your product, the juice, you know, just the criteria, your level of involvement in it. Mm-hmm. You know, none of the Cider Ireland brands are just farmed out to somebody else.
What is Cider Ireland?
Little umbrella organisation for cider producers who want to adhere to good standards.
Do you use the word craft? What are the terms that you use?
Yeah,
it's just Cider Ireland.
Cider Ireland, yeah. I suppose, we have a little kind of fairly loose, well, when I say loose, there's a little kind of manifesto as to how you would go about producing your cider. And it won't allow you to use corn syrups. It won't allow you to use that. It won't allow you to let it go to some large producer and have it contracted out. You need to be involved in it yourself.
You have to be the person that presses the apples and makes the cider. You can't have it contracted out, as Owen says. We also, you can't add sugar. You can't add water. There's a sort of strict criteria to try and say, look, we are trying to do something that is really focused on the quality. It's not about mass production. And as said earlier, the only thing we can compete on is the quality of our raw material and how we treat that raw material. So that's why we have this association. We made it an all Ireland association. So I think there are 13 members now in the whole island of Ireland. And every time we add a new one, our customers will go, "Oh my God, not another, not another craft cider producer." You're getting, "Jesus, there's only 13 of us."
Yeah, we think that's amazing.
How many are you importing, Anthony?
Just three producers. So we got to try all 13, and we work with our favorite ones.
So just give us the list.
So we've got Olin, obviously with his Dan Kellys. Then we've got Simon's the Craigies, which is the Craigies is both the Ballyhook and the Dalliance. And then William, who's on a plane right now and should be here.
Oh, I believe he's landed.
Oh, okay.
he's on the tarmac as we speak.
That's the Longville from Cork, which we'll be drinking later tonight. But can you tell me a little bit more about the about Cider Ireland? Because that's one of the things that really drew us to you. Would you consider it similar to an appellation? And would you want stronger ones? I mean, we love the idea of appellations. We have one in Asturias. We have an appellation. The French have one, although
the Basque
it has to be.
Region also, I think.
The Basque, yeah. Basque has an appellation.
What's the French one?
The French, they have one in Normandy and in Brittany, but the law over there, it can't be a dry cider. So most of the ciders that we work with are dry. Any of the sweeter ones aren't acceptable under the appellation because they're too sweet, although it's not that they're back sweetened. It's just the appellation only considers things that are the sweet version applicable. I'm not really sure why. Anybody want to contest it?
But I think the idea of Cider Ireland is to go down a path that will lead us to hopefully some kind of appellation system. We have quite distinct regional differences in our apples. So if you like, in Ireland there are three distinct bands of apple growing. We have the northern band in Armagh, and then you would have the band of orchards where Olin's situation just above the city of Dublin, and then we have the southern orchards, which are around Waterford, Tipperary, Cork, Kilkenny, and a bit in Wexford as well. What we need to do, the future of cider making in Ireland, in my opinion, is to start to accentuate those regional differences, because there's a different geology, there's a different geography in different climate. Mm-hmm. And the future for us is in the same way as the French have done for years with their wines, is to say, this comes from a very specific place, and our objective needs to be to display and portray the specifics of that place.
And if you can just put it into very broad terms, very broadly speaking, the main characteristic differences between the three bands, is it higher or lower tannins or sweetness? What is it that people can expect if they learn that their cider is sourced from the northern band as opposed from the southern band, for example?
Well, certainly from my experience growing apples, you will tend to expect higher sugars in the south. Even though Ireland's not a big country, it will have those differences. So I would see apples grown in the north will tend to be much firmer, denser flesh, lower sugars. As you go further south, higher sugars, less dense in terms of flesh. But juice yields will be possibly higher in the north and less in the south. But the sugars will impact on alcohol and flavor.
And I think obviously acids are another important component of the fruit makeup. Mm-hmm. And as Olin says, we're a small country, so you could never say that we have lower acid varieties. We always get very good acidities. Mm-hmm. Our cider fruit is the only one really where we get a relatively high pH. But when we're talking on the culinary apples and sometimes on the dessert apples, you could be talking 2.8, 2.9, 3 pH. And on the cider apples, 3.8, 3.9, 4. plenty of acidity, certainly in the culinary and dessert apples, which is important.
Yeah, and even sometimes you can pick up a very sweet dessert fruit and have it still be very, very acidic. You know, so it's about choosing your fruit, knowing what each varietal will give to your cider. You know, if you pick up Discovery, you'll have Discovery dessert fruit in the States. It tends to be very sweet, very fragrant, but still very, very acidic. So you'll use that with care. You know, you won't use too much. Well, for my style, I won't use too much of it. You know, so you have to be aware of the varietals you're using, and that's part of the fun. That's part of the challenge. You know, and going back to Cider Ireland, I think, you know, when people are actually, you know, voluntarily going in and partaking of the kind of standards that we're trying to set out, they are automatically trying to produce a superior quality product. Mm-hmm. So, and that's very important.
We like that. And Simon, what do you have to say about Dan Kelly's cider? So, you're going to judge each other's
I love what Owen does, and not just because he's sitting right next to me.
You guys are flying around the world together.
But we've always said that actually there's a certain similarity to what we do. You know, I think we both appreciate that body and color and structure that the Davenant brings us, and I find Olin's is the tannins in my cider are probably more pronounced than Olin's, and so it's kind of like, you know, someone once said to me, you know, it's difficult to compare these things because if it's like having children and someone says, you know, which child do you prefer?
We hear that part. We know that part, but what is it? Like the Dan Kelly's has like this kind of overripe fruit flavor. It's like real apple-y, right?
It's a very good apple flavor that I get from it. Like a, you know, a baked apple kind of thing going on that I'm detecting. But it's also got a like kind of a smoke element. Like right off the bat, the aroma is burnt wood. And it's softened up quite a bit now, but I find, like, sort of now on the finish, you get this really kind of sultry thing happening on your tongue.
And then from my perspective, I mean, in Ireland, do they serve your cider? Do you actually, first of all, sell your ciders in Ireland, or these are just export products?
Oh, no, we sell at home.
You do?
Yeah.
And what's the temperature, a typical serving temperature? Because right now, we've had fairly cold. Here, I keep things in a cold fridge in New York City.
Speaking for myself, I'd recommend kind of fridge cold, bar fridge cold. The style in Ireland has been to drink very cold ciders for refreshment. I think fridge cold tends to suit quite well. As you get warmer, obviously the flavors change, develop. But if you're selling in bars, I would just say, look, in a regular bar fridge. Without ice.
I probably there's one point I probably would slightly disagree with Olin on, is that I would go for a slightly warmer temperature. I think that particularly on, say, on Olin's cider or my Ballyhook Flyer, if it goes too cold, obviously the flavours are slightly numbed, the tannins tend to come out a little bit more. When it's slightly warmer, you get more of that, more of the flavours coming out. And you know, that's just a personal preference, but it's I think it's, for me, it's important.
All right. Well, it's been a great show so far. We're going to take a short break. We'll be back in a few minutes on Beer Sessions Radio. All right. Hey, welcome back to Beer Sessions Radio on the Heritage Radio Network. This is a special extra Cider Sessions with Gay Howard and Kay Michaels of United States of Cider. We're talking with the new forefront of Irish craft cider. They're not that new. They got Cider Ireland, 13 producers in Ireland, but they're here in New York City now, just coming in with Anthony and John from Rowan Imports. So what are you guys talking about?
We were talking about vintages, actually, and just how on the back of these bottles, it says these are vintage products and they change year to year. And on the front of the labels, they say it. And that's something we can't do in the United States. We're not allowed to have vintages on our ciders. we're not allowed to. The U.S. government does not, the TTB does not permit vintages.
So you're saying that's another thing that makes Cider Ireland, these are special craft products that they can actually be. I mean, how did you get?
Well, why wouldn't you put a vintage on the label? You know, I don't really understand it. We are trying to, you know, we as I said earlier, we only get one attempt a year at making it. We have one crop a year. For me, it would be more difficult to try and make something that tastes the same year in, year out. I want to be able to say, look, 2012. I mean, you can taste it in our 2012 Dalliance, I think, which is a... it's got that kind of more vibrant, fresher character, from which is very typical of 2012, because it was a pretty bad summer. So while we didn't get hugely ripe fruit, whereas our 2013 was a very warm summer for us, and so we got very good ripe fruit, and the subsequent mouthfeel that you get as a result of that higher levels of glycerol should be shown, I think. What's not to like about a vintage?
I like vintage too. I think with every product, whether it's food or wine or whatever, I think the more, you know, categorical, you know, I mean, how would you describe it, Kay?
Well, like, I mean,
what's
think,
better? You just have more categories, more challenges.
I mean, in terms of categories and challenges, I don't know. But I mean, the thing that I like about putting vintages on is that it reinforces the idea of seasonality. That we have specific growing seasons for things, that they are harvested once a year, that we do these things to preserve the you know, miraculous food that we're able to grow, and to drive that agricultural aspect, because you know, people need to know what their food sources are, because these, like as we've discussed earlier, are like our beautifully like produced small batch products that take a lot of care, that take a lot of consideration into taking care of the trees and to taking care of the fruit and producing wonderful flavors, because everything you do to something affects its flavor. And when you have like a mass industrial produced thing, if you're freezing the juice and saving it for later and then making cider from it in, you know, July, it tastes differently, and we don't get the same sort of sensory experience for it. Our bodies don't react to it in the same way. So yeah, I'm all for vintages. Appellations, I think we were talking about earlier. I think you know, it's kind of exciting. I know that when I buy something that has a certain appellation, I know it's guaranteed to be of a certain ilk, right? But in the U.S., I'm sort of against it. But I don't know why. I just think it's like it's our American way. We kind of do what we want. And
I'll disagree with that. Uh-huh, yeah. I would love to see it. Maybe that's because, you know, as uh-huh. importers and distributors of it, we're always trying to find ways to really hone the message of the products mm-hmm. that we work with. I love the appellations because, first of all, what you mm-hmm. said about them I think is completely true, that it guarantees a certain level of care that's put into the product. Mm-hmm. It says that this person knew that it came from this specific place.
Yeah.
We're going to try the Aaron Burr ciders later and mm-hmm. how he even has his North Slope, his South Slope.
Mm-hmm.
I think that's amazing.
It is amazing.
The flip side is that since most true cider apples are coming from Lebanon, New Hampshire right mm-hmm. now, we don't really have the production to have appellations for it.
Mm-hmm.
So, you know, apple trees take a long time to grow. I mean, how long are your trees, or how old are your trees, would you say?
Well, we have a range. We have a range on our farm that are just a little, some from a little over 50 years old to some that are about 10 currently.
And what do you think is the proper age for a tree before it starts producing really well-rounded fruit?
I think typically you need it to be 10 to 15 years of age, because younger trees will produce smaller numbers of fruit, but they'll be larger.
Mm-hmm.
So a lot of that energy has gone into producing large fruit, which tends to have not as good a taste profile. The older trees produce bigger numbers of fruit, smaller fruit, and they tend to be different flavor profile, tend to be nicer. So, you know, I would say that the older trees still work very well for us. There was one particular block that we... that hadn't been cropping very well, and we had looked at it for a while and kind of went, you know, we're going to have to replace that, take that out. And we didn't get around to doing it that particular year, and the next year we looked at it again and went, yeah, we have to take that out. Again, for whatever reason, we didn't get around to doing it. And the following year, same conversation. We still didn't get around to taking it out, and it produced a mammoth crop and continued to do so. So sometimes the blocks will take, they need almost a rest.
Mm-hmm.
And that's the kind of thing that will happen. But an older tree will produce, I think, nicer, more flavorsome fruit.
Well, and then, Simon, so the next cider, we're waiting for your buddy from, was it Longville House?
Yep.
Who wants to talk about this cider? Why don't you start, Olin? Okay, will too, man.
I'll
go for it, Kay. Longville House.
Yeah, Longville House. I mean, this is lovely. It's definitely, again, getting a lot of baked apple or cooked apple from it. Also, I'm getting sort of coriander, a little bit of bitter and spice on the end, which is really nice. Not as much tannin in this one, I don't think. But
What do you think, Kay?
Very well balanced.
Well, I'm enjoying it. Kay's much more articulate at pinning down flavor, so I defer to her at this point.
Mm. And then Owen, really speak about your colleagues. Are you guys colleagues or competitors or what?
Well,
friendly competitors.
Yeah, Longbow House.
Yeah, we all like each other through our faces, through each other's faces. You know, we have the lives out from behind. No, look, I got to say, you know, we get on very well with the guys. We all know each other. We're able to pick the phone up to each other and say, you know, how are you getting on with this guy or that guy? You know, I think there's certainly a great camaraderie amongst generally the producers. You know, Ireland's too small of a country to have too many enemies.
So if I said next year we're going to announce the Irish Craft Cider Awards on Heritage Radio Network, yeah. Who would you nominate?
I got to say, I am a big fan of Craigie Ciders. I think the ethos is very good. And again, it's not just because Simon's sitting here beside me and he's taller than me. I'm a big fan.
$20 later.
Yes, you can fix me up. So, big fan. And there's lots of really... There are lots of actually really good product. Another guy quite local to us who isn't represented on this occasion, Mark Jenkinson, makes a lovely cider. Obviously, William down at Longville, great family history to William's place as well. You know, he's got some nice ciders, and you know, there's room for everybody. And you know, if they're making nice ciders, why wouldn't you appreciate them?
I think cider is a civilized drink, and you probably agree with me, Kay.
I do.
Starting about 1:30 today, it's kind of lunchtime.
Yeah.
I'm feeling very calm and relaxed. My stomach was upset. And
absolutely. Well, you know, Gay and I have always been big fans of cider for breakfast.
Oh.
It's lower alcohol.
Yeah.
It's great with food.
It's perfect way to start your day.
It is. Yeah.
What are the customs in Ireland? I mean, let's forget about the mass marketed Magners on Ice. You said that made a kind of a... Help spread the word of cider, you think?
Yeah, definitely. Look, I mean, you know, they did an incredible marketing campaign, and we've been able to skate in on their coattails. But as Owen referred to earlier, you know, Magners, for the most part, is drunk in pubs, in pint glasses, over ice. I personally, if it was down to me, we would be serving our ciders in stemmed wine glasses.
Just like we are now.
Just like we are now, because, you know, again, we're trying to accentuate the aromas of the cider and putting it in a pint glass with ice.
You know, I think people are against pint glasses anyways, and they talk about elevating the game. In terms of beer in New York City, Yeppe, who's the evil twin brewer, he also is affiliated with this great bar in Brooklyn called Torst, and he came in one time and we had some pints. And he really gave me that dirty look, as if serving anything in a pint glass is not the right way to serve it. And I feel that way. I mean, we're drinking with stemware, and you know, just like a wine is.
Getting all the beautiful aromas.
We're having a good time.
Yeah. Yeah.
But the thing about cider, it's you guys are in Ireland, and you know, what else is there about the Irish cider scene? I mean, there was a joke. It was one of those absolutely fabulous shows from the 1990s in England where, you know, the children of the hippies, they didn't really drink, so they drank cider. And it's, I think for a while it seemed as like a drink, a light drink. Is that how people perceived it?
A breakfast drink.
Yeah, yeah. Breakfast.
Yeah, you weren't an alcoholic if you had cider for breakfast.
Sure.
No, that was the difference.
Yeah.
I think we have there is a slow cultural change coming around. I don't like to compare ourselves to beer, but when we've seen what has happened in the craft beer market in the last 10 years in Ireland, it's been nothing short of phenomenal. I think it's been the same in the States and in New York in particular. But now we're moving away from these mass-produced things to more beers and ciders that articulate more of their origins. And as a result, we've moved it out of the pub, into the restaurant, into stemware, into food matching. And it's a very slow, long road because we've got a lot of people to convince. But I think that, that once we get it in the right places and it's served and recommended by sommeliers or by really good bar staff, then there's a kind of a snowball effect. And I think we're just beginning to see this now in Ireland.
Let's talk about what you guys are doing. So you're here in New York. It's March 9th, 2015. You're doing a launch for industry only.
Yep, tonight.
Jimmy's number 43.
Absolutely right here at Jimmy's.
And then where are you heading this week?
And then after that, we're going to swing by Proletariat. And then tomorrow, we're going to be at Queen's Kickshaw. And they're soon to be opening up Wassail down in the Lower East Side, which is going to be New York's first cider-only bar. Mm-hmm. And then on Wednesday, we're going to be at Owl Farm, which is one of the best craft beer and cider places. They now have almost as many ciders as they do beers on.
Huge selection. Mm-hmm.
Huge cider selection, yeah. Which is down
on draft, too, or in bottles?
Mostly by the bottle.
So, yeah. By
South
the glass.
South Slope, yeah. And then we're going to be at Cooper's Craft in their new Chelsea location on Thursday, which is one of the best Irish bars that carries true craft
Excellent.
Irish products. Mm-hmm. And we'll also be at the Ballymallow, am I saying?
Ballymallow.
Which is, can you guys tell me a little bit more about it? It's a craft Irish food festival.
Well, Doreena Allen, it would be kind of legendary in Irish food circles for everything she's done from her restaurant, from her family business.
Is this in New York?
No.
Or in Ireland?
It's a festival in Ireland.
Ireland.
We're doing a promotion for it on Thursday night. It's on Broadway, but it's for trade.
Doreena Allen is here to talk about the festival.
Yeah. So these are some good places. So when the show's aired in March, these are places you can go and still find.
Absolutely. They're going to be up the entire time. Yeah.
And then this festival is this week. Irish or just...
I think that I'm just not fully aware, but I think it's a big promotion of all things Irish, and particularly Ballymallow, which is a brand that Doreena Allen has, and she's just fantastically well regarded.
But Anthony, are you getting the craft ciders also into like some upscale restaurants and like Gramercy Tavern?
Absolutely. I mean, we're going to be Juliet's going to be here later today, so we're going to have everyone from Gramercy Tavern to Hearth to Nomad Hotel to we'll be at beer table tomorrow.
Beer
Table Pantry will be in Grand Central tomorrow promoting ciders if you want to come on by before you get on the train. Yeah. We're going to be all across the city. We've got about 45 different places you can see on our website. We're going to have all the schedule up there. It's rowanimports.com.
It's not irishcraftcider.com.
It's not irishcraftcider.
Come on, man.
If you go to Cider Ireland, they'll give you the link to it as well. Yeah. We're all over Twitter and Facebook right now. You can see the whole schedule, and please come on by to any of the events. We're more than happy to have you.
So, again, since our listeners won't be able to attend the trade tasting this afternoon, what are some features? Like, if I was working at a top restaurant or bar in New York City, why would I come to this trade tasting today?
I would say to meet the producers and learn about the cider. I mean, we really need to be educating people about what is true craft cider. And we're so lucky to have these people over from Ireland to really present it, to talk about their cider, about their apples, how they grow it, the history of it, and educate people what is the difference between something that's truly artisanally made and something that is a mass-produced product. And there's no one better than these fine gentlemen here to do it.
I think if we could leave you as the reader or the listener with one thing, is that cider is generally not what you probably consider it to be.
Yeah.
And so I'd say if you're an interested consumer or a buyer or really anybody, I would just ask you to try it, and I think you'll probably be surprised pleasantly, we hope. So.
Yeah. All right, and then K&K, any final words on what we tasted today?
Well, I'm just excited to finally have tasted these ciders from Ireland that we've been thinking about and hearing about for a while. So thank you guys for coming and bringing them to us. I think now that Rowan has brought them to the people should go out and have them. Obviously coming through what I taste, the quality of the apples, you can taste the heritage, you can taste the terroir. They all have distinctly good fruit quality and tannin and not a lot of salinity and acid, but really lovely, really lovely. Thank you for bringing them.
Hey, Simon, give us your final pitch for why you should be best craft cider of the year.
Well, look, I think that, when you think about where Ireland is, we're a small, very small island situated in the northwest corner of, sitting in the middle of the Atlantic, in the northwest corner of Europe. I've never tasted better apples than the apples that are grown out of Ireland. And I've tasted apples from New Zealand, Australia, France, and I reckon our apples beat them hands down. And therefore, as I go back to, again, our raw material, if our raw material is good, our job is just to convert
that. In Pete Brown's book, he said one of the Magners ads was filmed in New Zealand.
Yeah.
Funny stuff.
We don't need
Owen, wrap it up. Why should your cider be considered one of the best craft ciders in the world?
Oh, God. Look, we grow apples. We have a long tradition of growing apples. We've always made a little bit of cider. We're trying, we're exploring, we're constantly trying to find different ways of doing things better. We think we can recommend the drink as a nice little drink. I think the flavor comes out. It's easy to drink. It's good quality. And beyond that, everybody else has to be the judge, you know.
All right. Well, in closing, I'd like to thank our sponsors at Union Beer Distributors who've helped to bring this podcast to you tonight. They have many great ciders, including Farnham Hill from Lebanon, New Hampshire, that we've all been plugging tonight. Thanks to Gay, Kay, Anthony, John, Owen, and Simon. A lot of new friends here for joining me on the Heritage Radio Network. I'm Jimmy Carboni. This is a special extra cider session show. And thanks to our engineer, Jack Inslee, who will be putting this all together. Thanks for listening. We'll see you next time on Beer Sessions Radio. All right.